outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen.
Hey, Kyle, have you enjoyed all the skirmish this week with the Democrats?
I don't even know where to start with that one, to be bluntly honest. First of all, we should not even be having these conversations because previous presidents, this was their cognitive ability due to age was never in question because they were not senior citizens.
So we need to have the conversation.
We need to have the conversation, I guess. Yes.
What I think is hilarious, if it wasn't so tragic, is how hard people work to deny the obvious.
What lengths are they willing to go to? The guy can't even walk off stage without assistance.
What we see with our eyes, don't trust it now. I've got 50 years of great experience. I was thinking about a pilot who's going for his flight physical and fails it. And the pilot says, you can't judge me by the last 90 minutes. You got to judge me by the last 50 years. I've never had an accident. Well, no, right now we're concerned about how well you can fly the plane now.
Exactly.
But what's comical, because I mean, until Biden concedes, nobody can get in there and do anything because they're afraid, because he has all the power. He has all the delegates, has all the money, has all that, which is exactly the thing the Republicans were dealing with 4 years ago over the whole insurrection thing. I've got friends that will not even call it an insurrection yet. Yeah. Did you watch the video? Did you watch people going through the Capitol? Did you watch them smash the windows to get in, trying to prevent the consummation of an election? I mean, that's the very definition of an insurrection. And it's sad that our politics have reached the point that supporters of a candidate can't admit the obvious when it's right in front of their face until the candidate or the president or whoever, he controls the whole thing because everybody's so afraid of power and where it might go and how they might get left out. So if the stakes weren't so high for the future of our country, this would be hilarious. This is sitcom material. This is the getting somebody to fill in for the president's body because he's dead. So this is Dave or whatever that movie was back in the day.
Yes. Yeah. I remember that old movie.
It's going to be interesting to see how it all sorts out, though, isn't it?
So I was literally writing my social problems sociology class syllabi the other day.
Why isn't it a syllabus? How many of these are you doing?
I have 6 syllabi that I have to get created between now and when the school starts.
That term itself triggers pressure for me. When somebody's handing you a syllabus and you collect them the first week of class and there's 6 of them, must be better giving them out than it is getting them.
I mean, yes and no, because part of it is when I'm handing them out, this is a open door to the experience or kind of an outline or framework to the educational experience that they're going to go on. And so that part is exciting for me. But I was literally writing up and I switched a couple of days, what we were going to do that week, so that we could have a lot of dialogue on and around the election, because it's going to be right in the middle of the semester. It literally is sitcom material. If it wasn't so serious, if it wasn't the actual election that we are about to be going through in November 5th, and we've got the current situation that we are facing, I don't even know what to say.
It's amazing to watch most powerful people in our country unable to be honest and true about what everybody knows and sees in front of their face, because of how it's going to impact them. So
yes,
their primary love is expedience. It's not truth. It's not reality. It's not, I'm going to hold to what's true, even if it costs me. It's, I've got to play this game.
Yes.
To hold on to power and try and, I mean, just to watch Adam Schiff on Meet the Press was trying, eventually, we know he'll make the right decision. I mean, every way he's saying, Joe, you're tired. You're done. Go home, rest, have a good time. And yet, without quite saying it, because he's not got the green light yet from where it matters.
I don't know. It's frustrating to me because it's like, okay, so then if this is how we're leading it out, like if we've completely punted the common good and the fact that you are in that office to serve the United States, the people of the United States, if we've completely punted that idea, which it kind of seems like we have.
Oh, probably five presidencies ago. Yes.
Yeah, there's a decent argument for that. What are we doing now? Like, what, especially as a young person, as a voter, as somebody who wants to see this nation still be able to move forward. It's like, I don't even know how to ethically or morally engage in this process anymore because of the current state that it's in.
Well, it's a good thing we're powerless because it doesn't matter what we're going to say or do anyway. And this isn't a political show, so we can move on. But
that's fair.
it is providing some interesting summer entertainment, even though the consequences are dire.
Oh.
Again, the fear is all of it matters is winning an election. And so both sides got to piece that together however they have to. And you're right. We, the American people, are not served well by any of this on either side.
No.
And it could lead to some desperate times. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And we're not political pundits, so save your letters. You don't have to tell us what stupid idiots we are. We just thought we had a little fun with that. So what's the best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
Ooh. Oh, man. I think the best thing that I did this week,
changing the rules again, I see that,
was competing. For those of you who are not watching the live stream, I'm currently holding up a mug that has
that
the emblem
anyway.
The emblem of the Wyoming wife carrying competition. My wife and I decided to randomly compete in the Wyoming state championship for the wife carrying competition.
Sounds fairly sexist. How come there's no husband carrying competition?
It could be a little more challenging. I would be very impressed if my wife could carry me of any kind of distance. That would be pretty
impressive. How far was this event?
A little over 200. So it was like 275 yards.
And this is a wife hanging off your back because she's upside down with her knees on your shoulders or something crazy?
That is correct. And I think for me, my favorite part of the race was, so there's several obstacles that you have to go over during this thing. You have to go through a mud pit and you have to climb this sand hill and you've got have to go over a hurdle. And I went over the hurdle and my wife like knees me in the side of the head. And so I'm seeing spots and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to complete this thing standing up because I'm seeing black spots in my vision.
I now understand why you carry them upside down.
Yes.
If you get kneed somewhere, the head's probably a good shot.
Yes, that's correct. I would rather take it in the head. But Jess, in the midst of the laughter and in the midst of the fun, was just encouraging me and saying, Kyle, everybody was yelling all around us, but her voice was the only voice I could hear. And she's like, Kyle, you got this. You can do this. And it was so encouraging to me, even though it was a fun and kind of stupid race, just to hear Jess prodding me on and championing me in that experience together while we're laughing and doing it together as a partnership. It was a lot of fun. We haven't laughed that hard in a while. So it was just a joy to be able to do that together.
And did the girls enjoy watching it happen?
Oh, they were dying laughing.
I bet.
Yes.
And you came in second?
Oh, yes, we got second in the state, actually.
Out of how many? How many teams do you think?
10.
Okay. And this was the first, this is the one and only heat.
You run against one other couple through the track, and then it's the best overall time. And then the number one team actually gets to go on to nationals in Maine and compete against hundreds of couples from all over the United States, which would be kind of wild.
You got to be glad you didn't advance, huh?
Yes, a little bit. Yes. Yeah. I'm glad that we didn't have to go and do that.
That at my age, I'd be having back surgery. No doubt about it.
So what's the best thing you heard this week, Wayne?
Debating a couple of things here. We got a trainer for Mandy. Finally, first time we've ever done this with our dog. And one of the things she said, it's guaranteed training, but they leave you with about 20 rules you've got to follow. And if you don't follow, it's not guaranteed. And I don't think we're going to follow all the rules anyway, so we're going to get as much training as we can out of this. But it's just not the way we want our dog to be, even though we do want her to be better behaved. And we are getting to that point. But at one point he said, like, even if Mandy just comes into my studio here, I'm not to touch her or pet her. because she's initiated the contact. And because she has initiated it, that gives her dominance in the pack. And so if I hear her coming down the hallway, I can call her. And if I can call her before I see her, then I can pet her. And if I can't, then she got to come in and I kind of just keep going on like nothing's happening. And then when she turns to walk out, call her back in. And then I've initiated. And it seems a little tightly wound. So I'm not necessarily loving that, but it got me back into the thought about how God is the initiator in our journeys and how much of our discipleship has tried to make us the initiator. So, and I get this email a lot, you know, having my prayer time, my Bible reading, it seems like God, my prayers don't even pass the ceiling, which is already a problem because if you're worried about your prayers getting above the ceiling, then you've got God up in the sky somewhere instead of right in your heart. So that's already a sign that, okay, something's the metaphor, the picture, whatever is a little bit off. But I love the fact that it's God who initiates. And it reminded me of the last 25, 30 years. I've been learning to let God initiate. I've been learning to sense that moment of feeling drawn. And then when I'm feeling drawn, yield into that place. And it can be driving a car or the RV, or it can be anywhere where that drawing comes from the inside. And I think of Jesus' words, no one can come to the Father unless the Father draws him. And we always thought that was salvation oriented.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's when God draws you, when you recognize the drawing, then draw away to him, find that space to engage him. So it's led to some interesting conversations this weekend with a few people about, particularly when we're, you know, Bible reading and prayer time and hour and somebody who's fairly faithful to that and just asking, was how often does that seem empty? Like most of us, a lot of the time it seems empty. It seems like I'm doing the right thing. I've done the discipline. I've spent time, but an hour later, I couldn't remember a thing I read or prayed or because engagement didn't really happen. We did our part, quote unquote, and then God, what God didn't do his or, because I find in my own journey, I love when God speaks to me. I love when he gives me insight into stuff. But I don't initiate when that happens. Almost never. Not the real stuff. Not the really good stuff. It's like shaving one morning and there's two doves sitting on the rail. It's God who wants to make himself known. And it's helpful if we can learn how to recognize when that's happening and lean into it. And it doesn't say, you know, Bible reading and prayer is a bad thing. I'm not saying that. I do it regularly myself. But it's a different expectation that I put on all that. It's not, that's my God time. No, I'll read, I'll hold some space, pray with him a bit, pray to him. But I'm looking for how he's initiating. Where's he drawing? What's he saying? Talking to a young couple last night, got some big decisions to make in a brand new marriage. And they're trying to make decisions that are 5-10 years down the road. And I was saying, you know what? You can lay out your plan right here, right now. When you get there, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So let God initiate when we need to talk about those things and when he has clarity, because a lot of things I've prayed about in my past, I can tell you, God had nothing to say to me when I was begging him to speak that I could have understood. If he would have told me what he wanted, and maybe he did, and I just, you know, right over my head, because I don't get that. But some months later, circumstances would work out where now I do see what he wants. And I can follow that. And so I've been reminded this week to let God be the initiator in our journey. I don't feel like God's the big dog and I'm the little puppy comes in, gets ignored by God till he's ready. I don't think all that applies.
Yeah.
But I do think the idea of that God is the initiator of creation, of life, of the coming of the sun, of, you know, whatever. He initiates. And to the degree that we can tune into that and flow with it, then I think the freer our life becomes.
How or why did it become the model that we're the initiant? I mean, especially for me, the first 20 years of my life, that was the entire model that was given. That was the only model that was given, was you create this intentional quiet time. You read so much of the scripture. They literally had, I mean, I grew up Baptist, so they had a pre-prescribed 5-step plan of exactly how you do your quiet time every day, you know? And so, I mean, I remember trying it and just being like, this is awful. This is so boring. Like, there is no life here. And yet I've got to keep doing it, because if I don't, then God's not going to, this is the time that God's going to meet with me. And putting so much pressure on that time for God to come through, for God to connect with me, for something to light up in that time, instead of being able to relax in it and be looking for him and enjoying trying to see his fingerprints in the everyday moments, no matter where they were. How did it become the model? Why did it become the model that we were the ones initiating?
I don't know how or why. I know for me, the lie I was told that I didn't know was a lie early on, and probably the person telling me didn't know it was, but it wasn't true.
Yeah.
And that is that God's already done everything for us. And so now it's up to us. You know, God's already done this, done that, wants this engagement. So now you have to do what you do. And if it doesn't work, it's because you're not doing it enough or right. And then so many proof texts you pull out, you know, David says, early in the morning will I rise up and seek you. So you got to do it first thing in the morning, which is a death knell to our night owls in the body of Christ.
Correct.
Yeah, early. I'm never going to see him early in the morning. I mean, I'm up at 5 o'clock every morning, whether I need to be or not. And so I love the early, I love sunrise. I love all that early morning stuff, but it's just, that's when it worked for David. We take the scriptures and make them a prescription. So because I have a scripture like that, so get up in the morning, spend an hour, because what should you do? Well, Bible reading is important and prayer is important and prayer lists and navigators, I think, took that on steroids because people are too stupid to engage God. So we're just going to give them a bunch of things to do so they can feel like they have. And I think the frustration of people who go through those hoops and then feel like it's empty, all they've got is self-condemnation. It's my fault. I'm not doing it right. Or maybe God doesn't really like me. And it's because we've put ourselves in that place of initiation. I think we just miss the way God works and speaks and is inviting us into. It's not that God's saying, oh, I don't respond to that. It's no, I'm responding to that. But because you're focused on what you're doing, you're not seeing what I'm doing. And I would definitely want to see what he's doing. I think that was the lie. It was always, God can't if we won't. God's done everything, pertaining to life and godliness. So if it's not working, it's your fault. And it just kept creating, what do we need to do to prime this pump? And to realize it doesn't work that way. It wasn't meant to work that way. And if you feel like you're crashing your head against a brick wall, you are in fact crashing your head against a brick wall. I think it's wonderful to know that. I wish I'd known it younger. And I wish people would have instead just said, here's how to recognize God drawing you. And here's some things you can do when he does draw you. But be careful. Don't think that doing of things is what God wants or will prime that pump. Find a connection to him and keep leaning into that space. Hmm. And I think that would have been a better teach than the teaching we did about here's all the things you should do.
Do you think that that initial teaching or that initial prescription ever came out of an actual relational experience? Because I've thought about that, right? Like, I often, if somebody writes a book or somebody creates a 5-step plan or they come up with some seminar or whatever, because they had an impactful or meaningful experience, relational experience, whatever, that was transformational for them. And so then they say, okay, well, that has to be the way that I'm going to teach other people how to have the same transformational experience that I had by doing it the exact same way that I did it. Do you think that that was ever relational? Because I don't know.
Yeah, I think it could have been. They something connected them to God, and then they made a formula out of it. And I think we're notoriously doing that. We talked before about people that seek God. God gives them something to do. They go do. Then they create a program called Beach Church or whatever, because that's what sells a book. And people buy a technique.
Yeah.
You can't sell a connection. You can't sell it. So you've got to sell a technique. So I'm cynical enough to say, yeah, a lot of it has to do with money. Like somebody wrote me last week, I want to be an expert in spiritual things and ask provocative questions like John did, and so you don't want to go to church anymore. Can you teach me to do that? I'm going, no, that's a way of being. That's not a technique. And if you want to be an expert, that's the first problem.
Correct.
But I do know when you start to write a book, whatever, they tell you, be an expert at something. Find something that If you're not an expert, you can pretend to be an expert. And one of the quickest ways to do that is to have terminology that's unique to you. So when I hear a speaker go, here's what I call that, and they use some kind of term that's not even that big a deal, I know exactly what they're doing. They're setting themselves up as an expert. People will pay for their book or their seminar or whatever, so they can learn a technique that's not going to work for them. But we've actually sold them, I think, in those things. The reason, well, it works for some people, I think they're placebo effects. We actually give them a technique, and now I've done the technique, and I either have to pretend it's working and do it with other people, or I've got to admit that I'm no good at this God stuff and give up or be thought of as a failure. And so actually, people will pretend to get better if you give them things to do, because it's like a placebo. I have to make it look like it's working. Otherwise, I'm a jerk. And when we put the onus on God instead of ourselves, that opens up to a whole different set of, okay, well, I'm trying to listen to God. I don't hear him. And so how might I connect with him? What am I missing here? That leads to a much better conversation than, well, here's the four steps to deal with trauma, or the three steps to climb a tree, or whatever we're trying to get people to do. And I find the relational journey is so engaging. Why would you want to give anybody anything else? So was it relational to begin with? Maybe. But very quickly, they got sidetracked into something I want to teach on or sell or be an expert in. And all those are roads that lead away from the God drawing and back to us initiating.
I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about vulnerability over the last couple of weeks. So I listened to a teaching series that Brené Brown did on men and women and vulnerability, okay, which was really, really good. And then I've been doing some of my own personal trauma counseling. I started up doing EMDR therapy for the last roughly 3 weeks. I've been doing EMDR.
Which is what, for those that don't know?
It's a specialized trauma treatment. So what often happens is our brain, or especially our subconscious, it gets a traumatic experience, gets stuck in one of the two hemispheres of our brain. So either it gets stuck in the emotional side, so we can have all these big emotions that we don't know what they're tied to, or it gets stuck in the logical side, where it's like, okay, I can tell you about a horrific memory and there's no emotional component to it whatsoever. It's just flat affect. There's no response. And so
this is the ultimate compartmentalization, right?
Yes,
exactly. Stuffed it over here, I've stuffed it over there, but never the two shall meet.
Correct. Exactly. And so EMDR is a process where it actually helps move from one hemisphere of the brain to the other hemisphere of the brain, so that your mind can process that trauma in a wholehearted or holistic way and then shelve it. So now it's actually shelving it where it's still a memory. It's still something you can learn from, but it doesn't have the claws that are tearing apart your life or tearing apart the lives of others anymore. It's been declawed. Yeah, so very interesting experience. I did some training with it before, and it's very different being the client than it is the person going through the training on how to do it.
This goes back to what we said about discipleship. Very different being the one teaching about what you should do than being the person who has to do it.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. And so what started this whole conversation was in this podcast, or in this teaching that Brené Brown did. She's talking about the differences between the way that men are vulnerable and the way that women are vulnerable. And especially in our culture today, there's this idea that men should be more vulnerable. They should be more open. They should be more emotionally intelligent. They should be more accessible, right?
Yeah.
And yet what they're finding in the research is that all of a sudden when they start to move in that direction and when they go there, then all of a sudden they're getting this response back from women of, no, I don't want to see that. Don't do that. Don't make yourself, like, I would rather see you come on your white horse. You're the white knight on your horse. And I'd rather see you die on that horse than fall off of it in vulnerability.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what they're finding as she's doing this research and she's asking women, how are they responding to this vulnerability? They're like, oh yeah, I actually do that. When my husband becomes emotionally vulnerable, or they start to show themselves, or they start to open themselves up to me, I find myself not knowing what to do and repelling and actually telling them, no, I need you to box that back up because I need you to be okay. I need you to be the one that's fighting for me. I need you to be my rock or whatever it might be. And so I can't see the flaws. I can't see you falling off your horse. I can't see my white knight making a mistake.
Wow.
So then Brené goes into this whole process about how guys have started to learn how to fake it, where they're just vulnerable enough to where the people in their lives are like, oh, I'm emotionally connected to that person, but they're not actually letting their emotions out. They're not actually showing their emotions in a holistic way because they don't perceive it as being safe. They don't perceive it as being accepted because they're supposed to have it together. They're supposed to still be able to fight. They're supposed to still have things put together. And man, that's been a really interesting dialogue for me over the last little bit of like, okay, what do we do with this? What do I do with this? And there's a lot of shame that's tied into this. I mean, there's a lot of dialogue and shame. And this was this whole conversation. Brené Brown talks about having your cake and eating it too, that women want to be able to have the vulnerable, hard on his sleeve, emotionally intelligent man. And yet on the other side, she wants this stoic, powerful protector that has it all together and can be her rock when things get crazy. And these guys are stuck in this tension of, well, what do I do with this? How do I navigate this? And I felt like that as a dad. I felt like that as a husband. And I've also felt like that as a therapist, where I remember one day I went in to counseling. I had to go and do my job, right? I walk into the school and my uncle had literally committed suicide the day before. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I've got to put on that exterior. I've got to get back on my horse as the white knight, and I've got to go save and rescue and protect and be there for other people. And yet this was all going on.
Well, that's very different in a professional context, right? Where you show up to do a job. But you're talking about that in your own home. If I can't have the pain I'm having and have days of shock or grief, and my partner's got my back through that, then that's a whole different thing. Because to gird yourself up and get through a professional day and do the assignment I've got to do is one thing.
Correct.
But that's in fair. The environment which absolutely. I live, or even the friends I have, it's not just spouses, it's friends too. If I can't be honest and vulnerable and say, man, I'm really hurting right here, because people want me to be strong because they feed off my strength, even if it's an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's where it gets really weird.
It does. And that's one of the things that really initiated me even going and seeking out counseling again. Was I started after everything that went down with Eliana and her almost passing away in December, and then some stuff that happened with Jess as well. There started to be an emotional reaction from me. I couldn't hold it together anymore. There was anger, irritability, frustration, lack of ability to focus. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of different things started showing up, and Jess got caught off guard. She didn't know what to do with it. She didn't know how to handle it. She's like, I think I want to see this, but then when I do see this, I don't have the capacity to be able to hold this for you. So that was really intriguing. That's been something that, man, just trying to work through and navigate and figure out, okay, Lord, like, what does this look like? And my friendships, I have a few friends that I've been able to let those walls really down with, that I'm able to be around. I don't have to be on. There's no pretense or illusion that I have to maintain around them. And that's been incredibly healing and incredibly healthy. And having a professional counselor be able to help me kind of navigate through some of those things personally has been an additional resource that I needed. But man, it's been an interesting conversation of like, I need you to be this emotional, especially as a girl dad. Like, my house is just estrogen. I mean, we have a female dog, two daughters, and my wife and me. And so it's like,
so it's not all estrogen. You got a little bit of testosterone in there.
Well, yes. I'm the only source of testosterone in my home.
I know you like to dance, but still, Kyle, I think you qualify.
No, it's like, okay, maintaining this idea of being John Wayne and yet also being this emotionally intelligent, accessible, whatever it might be, person. So I would love to hear your thoughts or feedback on it.
Well, I start when I first start sharing about it. I think, you know, Sarah and I almost always, when these people talk about what the woman wants, what the man wants, Sarah and I are almost always on the opposite side of those things.
Really? Okay.
Because I find vulnerability really easy. And I've never had her, like, you know, pretend to be my white knight kind of thing or feel threatened by it. Mm-hmm. Sarah's been the one that's been more trying to be strong outwardly because of all the trauma stuff that was going on in her body that she didn't know about. So that's all that stuff being hidden. The first time we were kind of finding a reconnection to each other, and I completely lost it for about 2.5 hours with Sarah. I walked into her apartment for the first time and I saw our life. I saw pictures of me and her. And I for whatever reason, I was right back to the moment I read the letter some 3 weeks before, and I just lost it. I just told her, I said, I got to leave. I got to go, because I could feel it all coming. And she said, no, I don't want you to leave. And I said, you believe me, you don't want to see me this way. And she said, please don't leave. Please, please, please. Mm. And so I just went in the spare room at her apartment and just cried. I mean, I don't mean sobbed, crying, saying stuff that I couldn't stop saying that I didn't want Sarah to hear. Mm. All the pain that was, and not, into that for half an hour or so, suddenly Sarah is in the room holding my knees, kneeling in front of me. And I said, I'm sorry, babe, I just got to go. And she said, no, I want you to stay. It's okay. I'm sorry. And it just, she was not at all shaken. She's never seen me like that. I've never seen me like that. It's not something I hide. It's something, it's a place I've never been. Yeah. And I just didn't want to have it with her, not when our relationship, whether we get back together, not when I was all that shaky, you know, just didn't want to, but she held it in such a beautiful way. So when I look at this, I can say, yeah, in general, these things may be true. Mm-hmm. I think I felt a lot of pressure early in our marriage and early in my religious life because I was a pastor, and pastor meant you were an expert and you couldn't have needs. Mm-hmm. And I was even told you couldn't have friends. You couldn't be vulnerable and honest with people. You had to, you know, put on an image of strength and knowledge, and you've got it all figured out. But that wasn't so much in the marriage side of my life. That was kind of an assignment for the role I had. The more I discovered, this is into my 40s now, discovering how loved I was by God, vulnerability became the only honest way to respond. Hmm. You know, I found myself, like, when we share a story, people go, oh my gosh, you guys have such courage. It doesn't feel like courage to either Sarah or me, because being loved by God means I don't have to put up an image for you. In fact, I'd rather not put up an image. And if you don't like who I am, and then fine. I don't need you in my life if I've got to pretend to be something I'm not to keep your friendship. So in every way, over the last 20 years, Sarah and I have seen, and me much more so than Sarah, but now Sarah is really living the fruit of it too. Vulnerability and just honesty and integrity is the only way to live. If people don't see the struggle in my own life, they won't know how to handle the struggles in theirs. If I'm helping them explore their journey. And so vulnerability, I find it a treasure. I find other people are shocked by it. And then I think, maybe I'm being too open. And then I say, hey, I don't think so. If vulnerability is a turnoff to you, then, you know, if it would turn off to Sarah, I don't know how I would guard that or how I would deal with that. But in the other relationships I have, if it's a problem, then I'm really sorry it's a problem, but I'm not going to give that up to keep you in my orbit. Because I want to know the real you too. I'm letting you know the real me, but I'm the one to sit here and I've done that. You've been friends with people for years, and you find out something's been going on the whole time that they've never talked about, never opened up about, that would have given great light to the ways you were trying to help them if you'd had all the facts. But it was just a thing that was too vulnerable, I guess, for them to open up. So I don't see the same dynamic in our relationship. I can appreciate it in yours. I can appreciate why women, I guess, want the man on the white horse?
Well, I think one of the things, the question mark that I put down as you were talking, is capacity. For example, with Jess, she had just gone through an extremely vulnerable, very deep heart process for herself, as far as some mental health things and some intensive counseling that she did, etc. To have a moment like you did, where you had, you were in this place where, like, I've never even been here. It's like, not that I have an issue with vulnerability, I just never have been here before. Right. So I don't know what to do with this.
And it helped that I couldn't stop it. It wasn't like I had a choice here and I think I'll go with vulnerability. I was melting down and she wouldn't let me go.
So on that, I think that's the question mark that is kind of rolling through my mind, because Sarah was in a pretty vulnerable place then too.
She was.
Right? Like, I mean, she had just started to do some of the counseling stuff. Your guys' relationship, you guys hadn't come back together yet. Like,
we hadn't discovered even what her PTSD was from. Correct. Her bias was still coming from me. So then I'm thinking it must be too, but I don't know. I'm giving her a whole mouth. I'm giving her a fire hose of emotion that I'm not sure she could handle. That's why I tried to leave. I tried to leave so many times. She wouldn't let me go.
And I think that's the question that I'm still holding, is like, Jess, she said, Kyle, I have the desire to be able to hold this well for you in the future, but I just can't right now because of everything that she had gone through and the challenges that she had faced. She basically was like, look, I want to be here for this, for you in this, and I can take doses of it, but I just don't have the space. I don't have the capacity to do that yet. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an interesting space that I'm wrestling with, is differentiating between capacity. So they have the desire, they want to continue to deepen the relationship, but for whatever reason, whatever they're going through in their life, they just don't have the capacity to be able to offer a space to hold that emotion like Sarah did. Mm-hmm. Like, they just aren't there yet to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And versus somebody who is actively avoiding vulnerability, that's saying, no, I don't want to go there. That's too dangerous. That's too scary. I want the illusion, because the illusion makes me feel safe and comfortable. And so don't poke holes in that illusion. Like, don't show yourself enough to where you're poking holes in the illusion that I love. So please don't do that. That's something that I'm still wrestling with, and just being able to identify the differentiation between loving the illusion and getting annoyed when you're poking holes in that illusion versus capacity and wanting to be able to get there, but not having the capacity yet.
Yeah, and I don't know that we all know our capacity so well.
That's fair.
All I can do is just scream and say, look, I can't handle this right now. But I think I think a God person would begin to say, okay, my spouse is going through this. And yes, it's taxing me beyond. I mean, none of us know really what we can endure. We know it's
very true.
Painful right now, and I just don't want any more of this. But is that necessarily good for us? Is it good for us to be able to define the limits of our capacity? And I know we've talked about the difference between aspiration and capacity, and I think that's a wonderful conversation to have. But in the middle of a need that's right in front of me, if I think I don't have the capacity for this and it involves Sarah or someone close to me, then I'm going to lean into God in a way that says, how do you walk with me through this? Rather than I'm going to push the need away to protect myself. Now, also a place of capacity. I don't know. But it is true in my relationship with God right now. In the last 3 years, I have been pushed beyond my limits.
Yeah.
Or what I would have thought were my limits. And all the growth that's come from that says, you know, the really growth lies through challenges, not through comfort.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
I know we all want comfort, or I can't, I'm at the edge of my, I'm beyond, but even going beyond myself is where I found him and his strength and his resolve. And I think Sarah did too. Sarah is finding the same thing, that's from decades, yes, of learning to live inside this love that God has for us. So there isn't anything that comes my way that he's not bigger than. And it may be pushing me what I think is past my limits, but that's how I'm going to grow to a new limit. That's how I'm going to grow And I, so now I don't have the thought, this is too big for me. If I have it, it's not too big for me, because it may be too big for me. It's not too big for him. So how do I and God interact in a way that allows this to be something I can traverse instead of something I have to run from?
I feel like that's where the necessity of the relational connection is so important, because that's going to look different in every situation, right? Like, because sometimes God, at least just in the last year of Jess and I walking through some pretty intense things, there's been times where both Jess has had capacity for me, or like, as well, let's say she is leaned into God to have a capacity that goes beyond what she thought she had, and vice versa. I have done the same as well. And yet there's also been times where it's been like, no, this one isn't your fight. I've got somebody else that can walk through this with them. And it feels very kind, very gracious for Father to say, no, you've been going through it. My mercy, my grace to you in this situation is to actually bring somebody else alongside of them to help them navigate this space and to work through this piece of it. And that's, man, there's no prescription. There's no book. There's no psychological theoretical orientation that is going to help you know how to do that. That's where God's specific love and plan, his rescue mission for our hearts, is so vital. Like, we've got to be doing that relationally with him, or we're going to miss it.
Yeah. And one final comment before we go, because I think when you talk about having my cake and eating it too, or Brené did, I thought of that prayer that Lewis prayed for me when I was really hurting in that really dark time. And he said, God, can you take his pain away? And this was in a dream. He's talking to Jesus across the park bench. And Lewis and I were talking about it again this weekend. And he said, he said, everybody doesn't dream these conversations with Jesus. I was like, you're kidding, right? No, I thought everybody does this, because that's, but when he asked him in the dream, could you take Wayne's pain away? And Jesus said, I could, but to take his pain away, I'd have to take his love away. And that's one of the most profound things I heard a couple years ago was, how many times have it's made me question, when I'm praying for this and God doesn't do it, what would it take for God to do this? What would he have to do over here to make that happen? And I wonder if a lot of reasons our prayers aren't answered, it'd be like that. I'm praying to take the pain away, and God says I could take his love away and he wouldn't have pain for Sarah. And then when I know that's what's at stake, then the pain becomes bearable. I don't care how bad this pain is. Don't take my love away. That's something. And so having our cake and eating it too is one of those things to say, you know what? Take the more real road, not more than you can. If you can't, get help, but find the real road, not the comfort road. And that's the opportunity for growth and transformation. And then maybe we're not praying so many prayers that would ask God to do something he can't do, to satisfy something we want to. And I don't mean can't in terms of ability. I mean can't in terms of it wouldn't be good for you. Answer that prayer wouldn't good. So leave me with the pain if that means you leave me with the love.
Which is, I mean, again, that's amazing, because that the most loving thing and gracious thing he could do was to not take the pain away, because then that would mean you losing a huge part of your heart as a result of that.
And miss all that we've experienced in the last 2 years.
Yeah, the last couple of years,
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.